Hello and welcome to Four Corners, a closer look at one of the stories shaping your world. I'm Shahab Mossavat at the Press TV Centre in Tehran. The visit of the US Defence Secretary Robert Gates to the region comes at a strategically crucial moment. The United States declares itself satisfied that peace is beginning to take hold and that in Iraq the much heralded surge is working. Digging beneath the surface, however, a lot of residual tension still exists that goes some way to defying the wholly rosy picture the Americans would have us accept. The latest stop on his tour is Manama, the capital of Bahrain, where the representatives of 20 countries, including Iran, are gathered to discuss regional security issues. However, we are going to begin with where Mr. Gates started himself, in Afghanistan, where the UN estimates that insurgent activity has increased fourfold in the last year, and the Taliban claim to be in effective control of no less than 50% of the country. Reconstruction is at a virtual halt. Unemployment is rocketing, and goods and services available in Kabul and the urban centers controlled by pro-American forces are out of the reach of the vast majority. Against this background, opium cultivation is back at pre-Taliban levels and is Afghanistan's number one export. Kabulis have less than 4 hours of electricity per day. So, what did Robert Gates make of what he found?
And as we were reminded last week by Osama bin Laden's message to Europe, our enemies are counting on us to lose our resolve. They are counting on us to forget that the security of our people, both Europeans and Americans, is inexorably bound to the stability of Afghanistan. Friends and enemies alike know that the United States is committed to the long-term safety and security of Afghanistan.
Joining me for this half of Four Corners are Roseanne Klass. Ms. Klass is the director of the Afghanistan South Asia Resource Center in New York City and the author of The Great Game Revisited, an eminently readable account of the Afghan-Soviet War of the 1980s. We're also going to be hopefully joined on the telephone by Rahimullah Yousafzai. Mr. Yousafzai is a veteran journalist who has written extensively about the Taliban and believes the rise in Islamic militancy is a reaction to the unwelcome intrusion of foreign powers into the region. He is also one of that select band of journalists who has been granted several face-to-face interviews with Osama bin Laden. He is going to join us on the line from Peshawar in Pakistan. Also joining us in this half of the program is Paul Collins. Mr. Collins is the spokesperson for War on Want, a long-established British charity who, according to their website, are fighting for a world without poverty. Welcome all to Four Corners. If I can begin with you, Ms. Klass, in New York, why is it that 6 years on from the U.S. removal of the Taliban, Afghanistan is still such a mess?
Well, there are a number of reasons for it, and it's hard to summarize them briefly, but one of the major factors is the interference of Afghanistan's neighbors and other regional powers. The Taliban are not an indigenous organization, and also the use of suicide bombers and other terrorist actions against Afghans are, these are foreigners coming in from Pakistan, from Iran, and from apparently from Saudi Arabia and the Gulf, and trying to prevent stabilization in Afghanistan for their own purposes.
Rahimullah Yousafzai, are you there in Peshawar?
Yes, I'm here.
Good evening. Welcome to Four Corners, sir. Very kind of you to join us. I know it's a very late hour there. Robert Gates seems a much more understated kind of Secretary of Defense than his predecessor, Don Rumsfeld. What differences are there in substance between the two men?
In fact, Mr. Rumsfeld was very upbeat about the Afghan operation by the American forces and the NATO forces, and he thought that the war in Afghanistan has already been won. And we used to hear from the American military commanders at that time that they would be able to capture or kill Osama bin Laden in that year, but it never happened. But Mr. Gates, I think, is more calculated, and he's very cautious while he's trying to look at the Afghan situation. So I think he knows the realities, and he realizes that even after 6 years, they have not been able to defeat the Taliban.
Now, Mr. Yousafzai, I read an article of yours back in 2002, a year on from the invasion, where you described the fact that the Americans had yet failed, at that time, yet failed to capture Osama bin Laden, and that he was the prize that they were really after. Is it a case that their strategy and their targets in Afghanistan have changed?
I think there are a number of shortcomings in the way they are trying to do things. But initially, they had the goodwill of many Afghan people, and they could have done that at that time. But now, even the UN Special Envoy in 2001 for Afghanistan, Mr. Brahimi, he is saying that it was a mistake not to involve the Taliban in the new Afghan government or the new arrangement. So I think that the Americans, you know, with very few number of troops were able to defeat Taliban and also expel Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. But now I think you look that they have six times more forces, more troops on the ground, and they have NATO forces. There are about 50,000 foreign troops in Afghanistan. The Afghan army has also reached a strength of 55,000, but they are still not able to do the job. And I think it means that the Taliban have actually become much stronger, and now they are also attacking in those areas where there was no Taliban presence in the past, like Western Afghanistan and the North.
Ms. Class, I think he wants to come in.
Mr. Yousafzai does not mention a couple of the problems. One, incidentally, I'm getting an echo here in my ear, but Mr. Yousafzai does not mention, and is perhaps unaware of the fact, that there is almost nobody in Washington who really knows or understands much about Afghanistan. That has been the problem since the first day. There's simply a lack of informed personnel. So in terms of trying to plan or organize action there, and almost nobody knows the Afghans. That's number one. Number two is that the Taliban are a foreign agency in Afghanistan, but they are being aided through the Northwest Frontier Province and through the tribal territories. They have sanctuaries there. They are receiving weapons from through Pakistan, through the ISI perhaps, and also from Iran. All of this is working on the Afghan people. But
I don't think there's any substance to what you're saying about the Taliban being fed through Iran. I can take the point about Pakistan. There's a lot of documentary evidence to support that, but I think it'd be very hard pushed to make a case against Iran so far as the Taliban.
Weapon shipments have been intercepted. Weapon shipments from Iran have been intercepted. I mean, there's no question about it.
Well, I think there is, actually. But anyway, I'll allow you to get away with that. Paul Collins, welcome to Four Corners. I want to talk about the strategy. I want to talk to you about the substructure, the infrastructure that's there to support. I think that our guest in New York was pointing to the fact that there is a lack of infrastructure supporting perhaps very fine aspirations. But no reconstruction is taking place. Unemployment is at record highs. There is no substitute for the cultivation of opium crops. What's going on in Afghanistan? Why is it such a mess 6 years on?
Well, the poverty remains so prevalent in Afghanistan for many people. It's a hard life which breeds a climate where the Taliban can win support. And the fact is that the West, which earlier supported bin Laden before 2001, and now wants him dead or alive, and the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, who side with him. But the reality is that the West doesn't provide enough aid to Afghanistan, and so opium is a natural resort. And unless those international community leaders who claim to be committed to the prosperous future and a brighter tomorrow for Afghanis get put their hands in their pockets and gives more money to ensure that not only the infrastructure is improved, but the daily lives of people whose food is rising in cost and other essentials are lacking, then there is going to be an indefinite insecurity.
Rahimullah Yousafzai.
Well, quite a bit of money has been poured in, but a lot of it has gone into private pockets.
Well, that's
it has not been well used.
That's a legitimate point.
One misfortune for the Afghans is that during the communist period, almost the entire educated, trained, experienced administrative personnel, about 100,000 of them, were either murdered or driven into exile, so that there's almost nobody left who has pre-communist, non-communist experience in governing. The Western, or at least American, interest in getting rid of the Taliban and getting rid of particularly Al-Qaeda and bin Laden is not feigned, and America did not support bin Laden. That is a story that's been spread.
Roseanne Klass, you talk about the culture, the Afghani culture, and you spoke about it extensively in your book, The New Great Game, or The Great Game Revisited, rather. It is a culture that, for the last 30 years, has been ossified, isn't it? It's been in a state of atrophy and hasn't really developed. Now, why is it that the United States, with its hands on all the levers of power, hasn't actually taken any steps to try to create a new democratic culture in Afghanistan?
Because there is almost nobody in Washington who understands or knows Afghanistan. I happen to have more than 40 years' experience.
Have you been called on?
I was the first woman. Pardon?
Have you been called on by the American government to give any advice?
No, they don't know I exist. They don't know I exist. But I was the first woman to teach boys in Afghanistan many, many years ago. There's only a handful of people who have any understanding of the Afghans as a people, as a culture.
Yes.
And I wouldn't claim to have an in-depth understanding myself. But the point is, what is needed is a cadre, a mass of Afghans who have the experience to administer a country, and they are almost gone. They were killed, they were wiped out, they were driven out 30 years ago. And those who have survived are men in their 80s who don't have the energy to go back and do this again. Many of the younger ones are coming back now, and we can hope that they will develop into a group of administrative and governing people who know how to run things.
Yousafzai, please go ahead, sir.
I don't entirely agree with her that there are no Americans who know about Afghanistan. I have met a number of Americans who know a lot about Afghanistan. People have written books, people have lived there, and you know, Barnett Rubin and all these people, they are very good American experts on Afghanistan. I think they are also advising their government. We know that for sure.
Well, Barney Rubin.
Yes, Barnett Rubin.
I introduced Barnett Rubin to Afghanistan, and there are a number of people, but almost none of them, who know Afghanistan before 1978, who know pre-war Afghanistan, pre-communist, indigenous Afghanistan.
So is your suggestion that they have a an incomplete impression of what the country's potentialities are, that they see only a partial picture, a picture of a handicapped, disabled, dismembered Afghanistan?
More or less, yes.
Yes. If I can just ask you, Rahimullah Yousafzai, when America invaded Afghanistan, it said that it had a mandate to liberate, to bring peace, prosperity, and security to the country. How successful have the Americans and their NATO allies in ISAF been in achieving those goals?
I think if you recall President Bush's statement, he was saying that we are not into nation building. In fact, initially they were not trying to rebuild the country. The whole idea was to have a regime change in Afghanistan, remove the Taliban, and bring in a friendly government, and that was achieved. And then the other objective was to destroy Al-Qaeda and kill or capture bin Laden. These were the two main objectives, and they have been partly achieved. But I think that the victory will not be complete until they are able to destroy Al-Qaeda and also kill or capture bin Laden and Dr. Zawahiri and other top Al-Qaeda leaders. And also, they need to, involve the Taliban in the nation building and into the political mainstream, because I have now read statements from the British Defense Secretary, a number of other government officials in the West, also a number of Western experts. They are saying that, there can be no peace unless you involve all the opposition factions into the political mainstream, and that includes Taliban. I think that I don't agree, with her when she says, Ms. Susan, that Taliban are not indigenous.
You mean Rosanne Class?
I think they are indigenous, they are Afghans, but they are getting support from Pakistan, from other places. That is a fact of life. But the Taliban are all Afghan people, and they are fighting in their country.
Mr. Yousafzai, why is it that 6 years, or 4 years at least, after Mr. Karzai has come to power, he's sponsored by the United States, backed by them, they say that they're going to support him to the nth degree, why is it that he has not been able to crack the Taliban, to eradicate their political base, and to establish himself at the grassroots of Afghan politics?
I think there are so many reasons for that. As I said earlier, the Afghan people had great expectations, and those have not been fully achieved. They thought there would be peace and security, there would be more employment, there would be more economic activity. That is not happening in a big way. And then also the kind of military tactics used by the Americans and NATO forces. They bomb the villages where they think there are Taliban. So they invariably kill civilians. There is a lot of collateral damage, and that is creating anger against the foreign forces, and Taliban are exploiting that. Taliban actually were not able to put up a fight against the Americans initially in October 2001, but they were able to retreat, and they were able to save their manpower and their resources, and they were biding their time. So I think they have been smart in trying to use their manpower and trying to create trouble for the Americans. And now, as we know, they are actually fighting in the whole of western Afghanistan, the whole of eastern Afghanistan, in the south, and also in certain areas in the north, like Baghlan and Kunduz.
Paul Collins.
I think Mr. Yousafzai is quite correct about a lot of this. Of course, I'm looking at it from 14,000 miles away. I'm not on the spot. But from what I hear, he's quite correct on a good deal of this, with one exception. The target is bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. The Taliban was only a secondary target. Initially, the Taliban were told back in 2002 that if they would extradite bin Laden, they wouldn't be bothered. But it was their refusal to give up bin Laden and the other Al-Qaeda who were responsible for the attack on New York City who declared war on the United States.
Indeed.
We didn't declare war on them. They declared war on us.
Paul Collins.
So they're the primary target.
Certainly. Paul Collins, you're a strategist for an organization, quite a big organization. When Mr. Gates stands next to Hamid Karzai, who's the real winner? Who gets the greater advantage out of being seen together?
I'm not quite sure if I heard the question. Could you?
Well, my question is that when President Karzai appears with Secretary Robert Gates, Defense Secretary Robert Gates in Kabul, who gains more credibility from that appearance?
It's a good question. Well, certainly Gates is seeking credibility. One part of the equation, though, that hasn't been mentioned is the fact that the American invasion of Iraq as an extension of what was done in Afghanistan has lost a great deal of credibility for the US administration, and not least within its own country by its own people. And for Roseanne Class to say that America has lacked sufficient numbers of people in the administration who have decent knowledge of Afghanistan is an outrageous indictment of a government that went in with, like in Iraq, without fully thinking through the aftermath of that invasion.
I think the people who are paying for that are
the Afghanis themselves.
Mr. Collins, I think it's a little unfair to Ms. Class. I think that she actually condemned the fact that there was a lack of joined up thinking.
Oh yes, I'm not attacking her. I'm saying it's an indictment of the American administration that they lack that that ability to show some insight about a country where they have many troops.
Yes. If I can turn to you in Peshawar, Mr. Yousafzai, the death of Mr. Kazemi in Baghlan last month, how much has that affected the moderate agenda in Afghanistan?
Oh, I think that was a big tragedy because not only Mr. Mustafa Kazemi, but five other Afghan lawmakers were killed, and besides that, 59 children, I believe, were killed. They were all from the schools and their teachers, you know, and they were brought there to welcome these lawmakers. So I think that, you know, this was something which was waiting to happen, because why do you bring children and teachers to such ceremonies? But I must say that, the Taliban are denying their involvement. It is possible that they are involved, because they want to, create trouble, and they want to create embarrassment for the...
I'm going to have to cut you short, Mr. Yousafzai. We have to break for the news headlines in brief. And when we return, we'll turn our attention to Iraq and Mr. Gates' unannounced visit there. Please stay with us on Press TV. Hello and welcome back to Four Corners. Now, Robert Gates' appointment as Defense Secretary in succession to Donald Rumsfeld was a victory for the less hawkish elements in the Bush administration. It was a step forward for the more diplomatic approach espoused by the State Department and a personal blow to Vice President Dick Cheney and his doctrine of military adventurism. Mr. Gates is a shrewd operator, a former director of the CIA. He is an established Bush loyalist, having served both father and son. Mr. Gates visited Baghdad directly following his visit to Afghanistan. His arrival came as a surprise, since it had previously not been announced, a further indication that perhaps the levels of security in Iraq are still not conducive to the safety of American dignitaries. Speaking at a joint press conference with Iran's defense secretary, Gates has put a very positive spin on the success of the surge.
More than ever, I believe that the goal of a secure, stable, and democratic Iraq is within reach. We need to be patient to see the nascent signs of hope across Iraq expand and flourish so that all Iraqis can enjoy peace and prosperity.
But it cannot be denied, violent deaths have fallen, and the 500 or so Iraqi civilians who lost their lives in October represent the lowest levels since the immediate post-invasion phase in May 2003. To discuss how sustainable this improvement is, I'm joined in this part of Four Corners by Raed Jarrah. Mr. Jarrah is an architect, writer, and human rights activist. Among his many activities, he is Iraq consultant to the American Friends Services Committee. Also, Paul Collins joins me once again from London. Welcome to Four Corners, gentlemen. If I can begin with this question, Raed Jarrah. 18 targets for the surge to meet. In July, 10 of these were still unfulfilled. What has changed so radically since then that the Americans are claiming its success now?
It's a very valid question. I don't think that there have been many changes on the situation on the ground. The current calm in the number of U.S. casualties or the low numbers are not the first time that U.S. casualties drop. In fact, this is the fifth or sixth time that we face numbers of U.S. casualties dropping to 80 in around 2 months. So it's not a first. It's not unprecedented in Iraq.
But Raed Jarrah,
the casualties of the U.S.
I did point to the Iraqi civilian death count, and that is markedly lower. And I think that's really the case that we should be most concerned about. After all, U.S. military personnel are there in the firing line, and it's their job.
The numbers that you indicated are true, but they are not correct. It's the lowest since the attack on Samarra. It's not the lowest since the fall of Baghdad. In fact, the first months after the fall of Baghdad, the number of civilian casualties was very, very, very low. Some few dozens in some indicators. So it's not true that this is the lowest month since the invasion. We are still facing hundreds of civilians, innocent civilians who are falling. My point that I was trying to get through is that the low numbers of casualties on this American and Iraqi side that is happening now is a part of a cycle. We've been going through the cycle in the last 4 years. There are ups and downs of the cycle. And I agree with Mr. Gates that the current low numbers are no indicators for celebration. We need a lot of other indicators to make sure that we have a strategic change. And there are no indicators that there is any strategic change in
that. But Raed Jarrah, Nouri al-Maliki would agree with you.
The next few months might have more conflict.
Nouri al-Maliki certainly doesn't agree with you. He thinks it's a great thing to celebrate. He's been saying Al-Qaeda defeated.
Al-Qaeda is not the major element of violence in Iraq in the first place. Al-Qaeda might be defeated because of the work of Iraqis who have been fighting it, whether they were Sunnis or Shiites, whether they were within the government or outside it. In fact, the same people who attacked the coalition forces and the Iraqi army forces are the ones who defeated Al-Qaeda in most of the cases. So we're not speaking on a victory on behalf of the U.S. and the Iraqi forces. But the thing that Mr. Al-Maliki wouldn't agree with me on is that Al-Maliki tries to portray the current situation as a strategic change and victory. I don't agree with this. I disagree with this. I disagreed with Mr. Al-Maliki in the previous times when he tries to say that the situation is becoming better, because me and many other observers realize that we need much more. We need an Iraqi political reconciliation and a complete U.S. withdrawal to reach to a place where we can say we have a strategic change and the casualties will drop now. But in the current situation, we are just going through some cycles of violence, sometimes up, sometimes down.
Paul Collins, does War on Want actually have volunteers on the ground in Iraq?
No, we have partners who we work with.
What's the feedback you're getting from those partners on the ground in Iraq? Are they saying that the surge is working to their advantage? Are they able to fulfill their duties in a much more constructive way than they have previously?
Well, it's patchy, but it still is very insecure for many people going out in particular parts of Iraq. Although the figures have been produced to show otherwise, the Americans, particularly the Republican government, are looking to try and salvage something out of the whole affair, because in a year's time there'll be elections and they're hoping to get another Republican in the White House. So we shouldn't be naive about the spin that's coming from Washington. At the same time, our partners point out that what many say was the real reason for America invading Iraq, with Tony Blair's help, Britain's help, was to gain control of the oil. And the law that is due to be pushed through would give the West, Americans in particular perhaps, domination over resources which Iraqis should control.
And Mr. Collins. Mr. Collins, what we've been hearing is that a lot of Iraqis have been either internally displaced or exiled, and now that some of these are returning. However, the pattern of these returnees is to a process something along the lines of sectarian cleansing, if you'll allow the term. So that in Baghdad and other urban centers, we're getting a checkerboard pattern where Shias are living with Shias now and Sunnis are living with Sunnis. Is that the experience of your partners on the ground? This process of ghettoization, if you like?
We haven't got scientific empirical evidence over an extended period. Obviously, we need to keep monitoring the situation.
Let me ask Raed Gerrard then. Raed Gerrard, is there ghettoization happening in the urban centers, particularly of Iraq?
It is happening. This separation and partitioning between Sunnis and Shiites is actually a part of a bigger political agenda of a number of Sunni and Shiite parties who are working to split Iraq into a Sunnistan and Shiastan. A number of Sunni and Shiite parties, especially in the executive branch of the government, have announced repeatedly that they are for a sectarian-based federation that will create a Shia federal place in the south and, another one in the middle.
So, Raed Gerrard,
has been ethnic cleansing happening in the last few years because of these agendas.
Well, I think ethnic is not quite the right word to use rather than sectarian, because obviously ethnically, unless you count into the equation the Kurds in the north, ethnically there are very many similarities between the populations. So that's why I chose the word sectarian rather than ethnic. Now, what have the Islamic Army of Iraq and the 1920 Revolution Brigades been promised by the United States to come on side? Because these were former insurgent groups, and now they've come on board with the U.S. What have they been promised by the Americans to bring them on side?
I'm not a speaker of neither the groups, but I read their websites very frequently. And the last time I checked their websites today, there were very clear statements saying that we are never going to be on board. We are against any attempts by the occupation forces to include the Islamic Army and the 1920 Brigades and the seven affiliated groups to them. In the current process of the awakening groups, or whatever they are calling it, they are still fighting against the U.S. presence and what they call the
Al-Sahwa, the awakening group that you're pointing to, are actively pursuing Al-Qaeda in Iraq, actively pursuing their political establishments, and trying to dismember them. There must be a reason. Is it the $600 that America is paying each one of them?
The U.S. is paying $300 each one of them. The number of people who have been paid by the U.S. as a part of these al-Sahwa, or the awakening groups, is more than 70,000. You are speaking about fighting an organization, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or the Islamic State of Iraq, with some few hundreds of people. So it's a way more exaggerated setting. There are no proofs that Al-Qaeda and al-Sahwa had major clashes, unlike the fact that there are many proofs that Al-Mahdi Army and the 1920 Brigades and the Islamic Army, who are usually called insurgents and terrorists by the U.S., that those groups are actually the ones who destroyed Al-Qaeda's presence in many, many cities around the country. Well, so the 70,000 people who are getting $300 a month don't seem actually to be fighting against Al-Qaeda. It seems like they are the local militias that are being hired by the U.S.
Mr. Jarrah, you know full well that that the evidence is always going to be mixed. There's going to be a lot of obfuscation. We're never going to get the entirely clear or honest picture. We're always going to be beholden to those that report to us. And the reports that I have are by all indications that the Mehdi brigades have ceased their violence. They've said that they're putting aside their weapons, no more militarism by them, and that it is the Islamic army in Iraq and the 1920 Revolution Brigades who are actively pursuing al-Qaeda in Iraq and trying to either displace them, replace them, or eliminate them. Paul Collins, if I can turn to you, how important is the cessation of military activity by the Mehdi Brigades?
Well, obviously there has to be concern wherever violence is being perpetrated for different causes. One of the things that Warren Want has been speaking out about this week is the fact that you've mentioned $30 or $60. We're talking about $30 million or $60 million for private security companies, some of them British based, who have committed hundreds of human rights abuses without any redress. And the Iraqi government is beginning to crack down on them. The Afghani government is following suit, but the British government remains aloof to the idea that UK-based private security companies getting multi-million contracts from ministers in London should be accountable.
Lots of security men, lots of militiamen, lots of guns, lots of bombs, lots of violence. What's the economic situation like in Iraq? What's unemployment like? Where is the reconstruction, wealth creation, inflation, housing, services? Are they picking up?
These are legitimate questions. It should be at the door of Westminster ministers.
Well, what does Warren Watt say?
Well, we say that there is nowhere near enough development going on in Iraq, and considering Britain and America invaded 4 years ago, the country should be in a far fitter state. And there has to be some responsibility taken for that.
How much electricity are they in Baghdad?
Well, I don't have daily accounts that I can tell you about that may be as up-to-date as our colleague Raed might tell us. But what I do observe from reports like yourself that it isn't consistent enough. Daily life is a struggle for so many people, and the fact that so many millions have left, been forced to leave for Syria and elsewhere, shows the plight of the people whose future has been ignored by those who bombed and occupied still.
Right, Jarrah, how committed are the Iraqi people to a genuine Iraqi national identity?
They are very much committed, in fact. It's a very important question because framing the current Iraqi conflict is one major part of this conflict. The U.S. administration and the Iraqi cabinet are trying to frame the conflict as one between Al-Qaeda and Iraqis. But the majority of Iraqis have actually other ways to frame it. They are framing it as one between the foreign interventionists, the occupation troops, and Iraqis. Or, as you were saying, Iraqis who are fighting to keep their national identity against others who want to split Iraq into three different sectarian and ethnic identities. Now, according to polls that I always like to cite because they are facts, they're not just analysis, there are two polls that I would like to cite. One of them was conducted last month by BBC and ABC. It asked Iraqi Sunnis and Shiites whether they prefer to be divided along their sectarian lines. And 98% of both Sunnis and Shiites said no. We prefer to live in the same neighborhoods. We want to live in the same country. We don't want this type of partitioning that is being imposed.
How about the Kurds?
The other one was conducted a little bit earlier.
Any response from Kurds?
The other one that... Yeah, in fact, it's the second one that I'm going to cite now, if you let me.
Please.
The second one was conducted by World Public Opinion earlier, and it included Kurds. And it asked Iraqi Kurds and Arabs, Sunnis and Shiites, Christians, and like people from all different backgrounds. They asked them, do you prefer to live in one united country with one central government, or do you prefer to secede with your own Sunni stands and Shia stands and Kurdistans? And the majority of all ethnic and sectarian groups said they prefer to stay in one united country with Baghdad as the capital. Now, these numbers are very much different than what the Kurdish two ruling parties try to say. They say 99% of our population don't feel that they are a part of Iraq. They want to secede and create their own Kurdistan. These polls numbers are very important, and the methodology and the error margin of the polls that were conducted were excellent. The error margin is just 2.5%. So we're speaking about reliable numbers that bring facts on the ground that contradict with the mainstream narrative.
Now, if you just hold on for a moment, gentlemen, we want to hear what Secretary Gates had to say about the effects of the surge.
As you know, there has been recent months a dramatic change in the security situation across the nation. A decline in violence to levels not seen since the Samarra mosque bombing nearly 2 years ago. As a result, there's been a substantial increase in the number of refugees returning home. International investment in Iraq is on the rise, and more than 70,000 Iraqis have taken it upon themselves to defend their neighborhoods. In many parts of the nation, these positive developments have led to a growing sense of normalcy and hope.
Right, Gerard, a sense of normalcy returning to Iraq. Is there really any evidence that this surge and its effects are anything more than temporary?
I think the current reports of the Bush administration and the Iraqi government remind us all of what the former Ba'ath regime used to say. You know, everything is happy, everyone is happy. I mean, it contradicts with all of the common sense and facts on the ground. The number of Iraqi refugees who were, either forced to go back home or, paid to come back home, or because they wanted to go back home, is less than 1% of the number of refugees who are in Syria and Jordan alone. Speaking about a very small fragment, and if it was that significant as an indicator, how come when the 2.5 million Iraqi refugees left Iraq, no one was saying, look at the big disaster that is happening? How come when 25,000 go back home, according to their numbers, we should celebrate the success? I don't think that there is such a thing as the surge working. The concept doesn't exist. There is no way to reach to a solution for Iraq's disasters through a military surge. I mean, that's the wrong tool to deal with the current situation in Iraq.
Now, Paul Collins, you've witnessed a lot of situations like this, I'm sure, throughout your years with War on Wants and with other organizations. How indicative of a long-term solution, or how instructive of a long-term solution, is the establishment or the arming of militias, even if they're working for you?
Well, the relationship between the army and militias is one which can have a benign effect, but the situation around the world in conflict zones is often complex. What we don't wish to see is a continuation of the status quo, where Western powers, America and Britain in particular, use their muscle, financial muscle, military muscle, to engineer a state where their interests are paramount rather than those of those that they claimed to have at heart. And we've seen this all over the world, where there's a collision between business interests, oil companies in the case of Iraq, and human rights. And what we haven't seen from Britain and America, as far as their governments are concerned, is a recognition that human rights come first.
Right, Gerard, how much trouble are the Americans storing up for the Iraqi people in the future by the establishment and the empowering of sectarian militias, whomsoever they are? They may be acting in the American interest today, but how much trouble are they storing up for the future of Iraq?
Huge trouble. The current sectarian militias that are funded directly by the U.S. government are very similar. It's a continuation to the U.S. policy in Iraq, because we shouldn't forget that the current Iraqi armed forces are actually militias. They are, militias who took off their militia hat and put an Iraqi army hat. Many reports indicate that when the militias that ended up creating the Iraqi army were changed into becoming Iraqi army, they actually moved with their existing ranks. So your same supervisor in the or boss in the in the militia ended up your boss in the Iraqi army. Now, this structuring of Iraq as a sectarian-based and ethnic-based country started with the day of Paul Bremer creating the governing council, and it will not stop until the U.S. leaves Iraq back and gives it back to the Iraqis. This sectarian mentality in dividing Iraq and partitioning it is a very important part of the U.S. policy in Iraq. It's an important part that is rejected by the majority of Iraqi Sunnis and Shiites and Kurds and seculars and Christians. And it will continue, this policy will continue, as long as the U.S. is occupying Iraq militarily and deciding how to steer its politics and economical and military issues. And that's why the majority of Iraqis, 80% according to the latest polls, are demanding that the U.S. should withdraw from Iraq so that they can start building their country based on the principles of national belonging
to sex. Certainly, I hear you, sir, but at the moment, unemployment is at extraordinarily high levels. And if it weren't for the, well, you say $300, there are two alternatives. There are $300 models and there are $600 models. I'm sure you know that. If that money wasn't available, there'd be a great deal more unemployment and perhaps a great deal more violence. But I'd like you to just leave that there. I just want to wrap up with one final question, which I will
put
to you.
Let me just say one last thing. There are other ways to employ Iraqis other than giving them guns. They can actually create civil society organizations that can rebuild the country instead of arming them and destroying more.
Mr. Gerard, time has beaten us once again, as it always does on Four Corners. I'd like to thank my notable guests, Roseanne Klass and Rahimullah Yousafzai, who joined us in the first half, and Rayed Jarrah and Paul Collins, from whom you heard in the second half. And, of course, you for watching. We welcome your thoughts, comments, and ideas. Please email us on fourcorners@presstv.ir. I've been your host, Shahab Mossavat, from Tehran. Goodbye.